Lecture 6, The Heroic Ideal, Part 2.
Last time, I presented several possible hero systems which the Greek world elaborated. But there's another pattern of heroism which, though it may partake of epic battle and tragic destiny, includes other elements as well. A pattern of heroic life which can be identified in a number of legendary figures across a range of Indo-European and Semitic cultures. This is the pattern which, with the rise of folklore as a field of study in the 19th century, folklorists have tried to isolate and codify. There are a number of different elaborations of this heroic life. Four of the most prominent and best known are those by von Hahn in a work called The Aryan Expulsion and Return Formula, published in 1876, by Otto Rank, whom I mentioned briefly yesterday, a kind of ultimately renegade follower of Freud, most famous for his theory of the birth trauma as modifying, defining or determining a great deal of our lives. And not surprisingly, Rank's treatment is called The Myth of the Birth of the Hero in 1909. Lord Raglan's The Hero, published in 1949. Oh, that's wrong, I'm sorry. I don't think I have a date for Raglan. Yeah, 1934. And perhaps best known to many of us today, Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces, which was published in 1949 originally. Each of these four attempts to examine the heroic life come up with what they see as a basic pattern for that life, which they see across cultures, as I've said. Typically, that pattern consists of, in the broadest terms, some sort of extraordinary birth narrative, a childhood which is disturbed or unusual in some way, outside of the normal family situation, if that ever existed, but anyway. A series in the middle of the life, a series of adventures, tasks, labors, typically involving the slaying of monsters, a journey to death or the other world, and a return to civilization. And finally, the pattern generally shows some sort of unusual death, often dying young, in a mysterious way, left unburied, and so forth. Now, I want to take a minute. What I'll talk about in this lecture is first to go over with you two of such patterns, just so you have a more clearly defined notion of what they are, and to look a little bit at why this pattern might recur, and finally to consider a particular, though unique, Greek hero, Heracles, and a way in which he has been viewed. One of the most kind of satisfying examples of the hero pattern, I think, is that of Lord Raglan, because it's so neat. it's really a little list of heroic possibilities. Here's what you can tick off: how heroic you are, you know, by how many of these criteria you meet. Right? His list consists of 22 narrative elements in a life. Here we might think again in a way of Levi-Strauss's myth themes. He sort of has 22 myth themes, right, which characterize the pattern of the hero as he sees it. And he applies in his work, he applies this model to, I'll just give you a few examples, Oedipus, Theseus, Romulus, Heracles, Perseus, Jason, Bellerophon, Pelops, Asclepius, Dionysus, Apollo, Zeus, King Arthur, Robin Hood. You get the picture. Now, let me just recapitulate his theory for you. First, the hero's mother is a royal virgin. His father is a king. This sounds familiar from our own culture, right? Think about this, you know. In Judeo-Christian culture, I think if you grow up in this culture, you think this is a unique story, right? There are plenty of virgins who come home in the Greek world and say, "Dad, a god did it." And often fathers say, "Sure." Right? So, you know, this puts things in perspective for us. But All right. The hero's mother is a royal virgin. His father is a king and often a near relative of the mother. But the circumstances of conception are unusual, and consequently the hero is also reputed to be the son of a god. Okay, this is just filling out that notion of an unusual birth sort of story. Also, keep these criteria in mind when we look at Heracles a little later. Raglan continues, at birth, an attempt is made, usually by the father or the maternal grandfather, to kill the hero. But he is spirited away and reared by foster parents in a far country. We are told little or nothing of his childhood, but on reaching manhood, he returns or goes to his future kingdom. After a victory over the king and or a giant dragon or wild beast, the hero marries a princess, often the daughter of his predecessor, and becomes king. For a time, he reigns uneventfully and prescribes laws, but later he loses favor with his gods and or his subjects, and is driven from the throne and the city, after which he meets with a mysterious death, often at the top of a hill. His children, if he has any, do not succeed him. His body is not buried, but nevertheless, he has one or more holy sepulchres. Now, I've just run through that as a narrative. As I say, in fact, it's divided by Raglan into 22 separate elements. I might very briefly, actually, sort of with you, think about the Jesus life in this context, right? Royal virgin, the conception, circumstances of conception are unclear, has a human father, but is reputed to be the child of a god, right? This all sounds fairly familiar. An attempt made to kill the child, one might think here of Herod. But he is spirited away and reared in a far country, one thinks of the flight into Egypt. We're told little of his childhood. Again, there's very little anecdotal material, as I proved yesterday by forgetting the age at which Jesus went into the temple. And now we come, on reaching manhood, he returns or enters his kingdom. We might think here of the entrance into Jerusalem. Now we come to two elements, however, Raglan's numbers 11 and 12, which are certainly not a part of the life of Jesus, and I think interestingly not. Namely, after a victory over king, giant, monster, dragon, wild beast, etc., he marries a princess. Now here one might think of the temptation in the desert and the confrontation with Satan, but this, of course, does not result in a death. I mean, there's no killing involved in the Jesus narrative, and there's certainly no marriage involved, and that seems to me an interesting digression or divergence from what will usually be seen as, if anything, an oversexed character. Often heroes marry repeatedly, and marry is too nice a term, really. So here there's a total divergence in the Jesus myth or narrative from many other cross-cultural examples one might choose. And so forth and so on. We might follow out the notion that the hero becomes a king, and one thinks here of the inscription, King of the Jews, on the cross, loses favor, is clearly relevant, and dying a mysterious death at the top of a hill with a body spirited away, but a holy sepulcher. All of this fits wonderfully well, you know, and makes a lot of sense. What sense it makes, we'll look at in a few minutes. So that's one classic attempt to formulate what is the heroic life as we find it in many cultures. The second, which I want to look at again just sketchily, is that of Joseph Campbell. Of course, I mentioned in the previous lecture that Campbell's work, Hero with a Thousand Faces, is probably his most prominent and most successful work overall. As I said, he searches here for what he calls the monomyth. Just as in Raglan's case, though he's writing a decade or so later, again, trying to isolate what are those recurrent mythical elements, myth themes, as it were, that we find characterizing the life of heroes of all sorts. And here again, I'll just indulge in a narrative version, kind of compression, of Campbell's monomyth, so-called. I should, in order to kind of orient you, he has a lot of alternatives in here, so it may be a little tough to follow. Fundamentally, you're going to see the pattern of separation or departure, trial and victory, return, and reintegration into society. The mythological hero, according to Campbell, setting forth from his common day hut or castle, is lured, carried away, or else voluntarily proceeds, to the threshold of adventure. There he encounters a shadow presence that guards the passage. The hero may defeat or conciliate this power. You notice how the alternatives are sort of disturbing here? Either he does or he doesn't. Either it was or it wasn't. I mean, you know, it sounds kind of rational as we're proceeding, but in a certain sense he's claiming, well, he was either in a hut or a castle, and he either went out or stayed in, and defeated or conciliated. You know, no comment. Somehow I think I've never actually read this aloud before to see how the variants are really don't quite work, I think. The hero may defeat or conciliate this power and go alive into the kingdom of the dark, sometimes represented as battle with a brother, battle with a dragon, and so forth, charmed by a woman, same difference. Or be slain by the opponent and descend in death. Dismemberment or crucifixion may occur here. Beyond the threshold, then, the hero journeys through a world of unfamiliar yet strangely intimate forces, some of which severely threaten him. Tests may occur here in the narrative. Some of which may give magical aid, frequently helpers. Often one sees here animal helpers or helper twins coming in a hero story. When he arrives at the nadir of the mythological round, he undergoes a supreme ordeal and wins his reward. The triumph may often be represented as the hero's sexual union with the goddess mother of the world, sacred marriage, or his recognition by his father creator, or his own divinization, apotheosis, or again, if he came to gain something, to steal a bride, for example, or steal fire, he may succeed in the theft of that boon. Intrinsically, there is an expansion of consciousness, in Campbell's view, and therewith of being. The hero, at this point, having gone through his trials, whatever they were, and succeeded in whatever form that takes, the hero may now experience some sort of illumination, or transfiguration, or a new access of freedom of some sort. The final work in Campbell's monomyth is that of the return. If the powers have blessed the hero, he now sets forth under their protection, perhaps as their emissary. If not, he flees and is pursued. Occasionally there is transformation during flight. At the return threshold, the transcendental powers must remain behind. The hero reemerges from the kingdom of the dead in return or resurrection, and the boon that he brings back to his world restores that world, sometimes in the form of an elixir, sometimes more metaphysically in the form of a message which he has gleaned. Hope you followed all that. There is, again, something I think that sort of sounds right about that. I do think that we should, because for one thing, because it has these alternative choices. I mean, it strikes me in looking at it now for the first time that it's very much like a sort of computer menu. You know, choose A or B, and then that will branch out into your next set of choices and so forth. Campbell, as he puts all this together into the flow of narrative, I think does seem to capture some sense with which we identify. We think, yeah, right, that's heroes that I know do that kind of thing, you know. It is, I think, significant to note that Campbell cannot verify, prove this monomyth with a single instance. Or if he can, he has not. He did not, let me put it that way. While he has elaborated this wonderful picture of what it is to live the heroic life, and here are the sorts of life patterns that a hero shows, he never shows a single case which actually corresponds completely to this pattern. Now, that may well be because he has indeed included so many alternative choices. There's just too much there. But Okay, you get a notion, I hope, from those two expositions of the kind of pattern we're working with here, the kind of pattern which anthropologists or students of comparative religion have felt that they've seen in examining hero myths across cultures. Now, I think what one wants to address is why would this same sort of pattern be seen over and over? Here, I think the most useful approach has to be psychological or psychoanalytic. That it seems to me there must be, if we're going to accept this notion, something in the structure of the human condition or in the structure of the human psyche which generates this type of pattern rather than something which resides in cultural conditions. Because this, unlike some of Campbell's notions, as I mentioned yesterday, which he can find an exemplar of in one culture, the research of various anthropologists does seem to convince us that, yes, indeed, genuinely across cultures, there is some such hero myth, as some such pattern of the heroic life as this. And the cultures are, in fact, so widely disparate, whether in time or in space, that, in my mind, there must be something which generates this, which does not reside in the particular conditions of a culture. Now, the end of the hero's life, I think, could be readily comprehensible in psychological terms. Recall that the death of the hero is always unusual in some way. It seems not a great leap of faith to think that this unusualness, this extraordinariness of the hero's death may be a way of denying its power, denying indeed the power of death. The hero who dies young, or accidentally, or mysteriously, or fades away invisibly, may, we may convince ourselves or believe then, that he may have overcome death as we know it. Indeed, such a figure may have the potential to rise again. Certainly in memory, as I've tried to argue in discussing Homeric epic, in the telling of his story, but perhaps even in the flesh. Here too, this is a belief which is by no means limited to the story with which we're perhaps most familiar, that of Jesus Christ. There are numerous exemplars, I'm sure, cross-culturally, but I think even within our own culture, there are other examples of such a belief that the dead would in fact rise again, and physically so, be present in the flesh again. For example, more or less contemporary with Jesus, we know from a Latin, a sort of obscure Latin epic, that Julius Caesar, the other great JC, two great JCs, in, at least in my culture, I don't know about you, that Julius Caesar at one point is trapped in a storm at sea. Actually, very interesting parallels to the life of Christ, since there's also that sense that he might also might virtually walk on water. But at any rate, he's trapped in a storm at sea, and he delivers a great and megalomaniacal monologue in which he basically, Julius Caesar, basically stands up to the powers of the wind and the gods and says, "All right, take me," you know. And one belief he has here, which is contrary to what would be true in a traditional heroic code, is that if he dies at sea, which would normally be considered inglorious and a bad kind of classless death, okay? Julius Caesar thinks and says that if he dies at sea, then people may look for him to return. They won't have a body, and so they will always believe that he may return in the flesh, right, as a living being. The same is true of Nero. We know from Suetonius' Life of Nero, Nero the great Antichrist, if as Revelation would have it. But we know from Suetonius' life a surprising thing, that Nero, of whom we have that picture that he's the sort of devil incarnate who fiddled while Rome burned and so forth, well, after his death, apparently, there were various peoples who believed, who had been devoted to Nero, and believed that in fact he would rise again, and there were sightings of him. There were reports that Nero had been seen after his death. Well, that being the case, I obviously don't have to make much of a leap at all to talk about Elvis in the A&P. Or, and certainly last year, I felt like this had actually happened with all of the media events. Jim Morrison, right? We know he's going to show up someday. So, I mean, clearly, this part of the myth is still with us. This notion that the young heroic figure who experienced an unusual death may in fact rise again. And I think that psychologically, that's readily comprehensible as a desire to overcome death, to deny its power. Perhaps more difficult to understand, or raising more questions, is why would there be, at the other end of the life, this unusual childhood, or unusual conception and childhood? Here again, one Freudian explanation seems sort of intriguing to me and possible, namely that this is actually a kind of universal fantasy, what Freud referred to as the family romance. The sense that we all had, I think, or many of us had as children, you're not really my mother, I'm adopted. I can tell because you wouldn't let me watch the television last night. but Freud's particular elaboration of this is actually that he says the young child goes through this stage when he or she feels that these are not his or her real parents, and that in fact his real parents are a king and queen, or a princess, or whatever. So in one way, that Freudian notion might come in here, that the real parents are grander, are gods, or royalty, or whatever. And the second Freudian aspect here is the possibility that this kind of fantasy in the hero life also answers to a fulfillment of Oedipal desires. That is, Dad didn't sleep with you. It was a god, you know, or there's still room for me, or and so forth, right? So I think that provides a possible answer to why the childhood, as expressed in the heroic pattern, would have these unusual characteristics. Campbell's suggestion, however, about this is at the opposite end of the spectrum from the Freudian solution. In the Freudian view, this would in fact characterize all of our fantasies. These would be very common, if not universal, fantasies about our not belonging in the traditional childhood. Campbell, however, has a sort of an opposite suggestion, namely that this unusual childhood is the legend maker's way of denying heroism to us, of telling us, this ain't you, right? And positing the select. Now, you might notice, let me recall that, whereas Raglan begins with the unusual conception, the royal virgin, and so forth, Campbell's version of the monomyth, in fact, begins, I'll call to your memory, the mythological hero setting forth from his common day hut or castle, and so forth. He wants to eliminate this unusual childhood altogether, and not even to include it in his version of the heroic pattern. And the reason is, the reason for his neglect of birth and childhood mythical elements is that he believes the tendency to endow the hero with extraordinary powers from birth, or conception, indeed, obscures the possibility that heroism is open to any human being with courage and faith to transgress boundaries. The traditional pattern, then, in Campbell's view, would accord with the view that heroism is predestined rather than simply achieved. Right? And you can see here, I think, the Jungian-Campbell project. I mean, he does want to talk about heroism being open to us all as a possibility. And if it's the case that one must have had this unusual childhood history, it's not open to you where you stand now, in what you're doing now, where your life is, because you've already passed through that portion of your life and don't have the possibility of redoing it. Maybe. I'll come around to this in a second. At any rate, so since Campbell wants to believe that heroism is an option available to us all, consequently he begins his tale of heroism with the middle of our lives, as indeed does Dante, for example. However, let me go back to that notion that, after all, you can't go back and redo your early childhood history. If the deeds of an actual historical figure proclaim him to have been a hero, right? Let's say that a culture has a potential heroic candidate in some way. Many believe that what will happen in that case is that the builders of legend will invent for such an individual the appropriate adventures, right, to fit into the heroic pattern, which is generally abroad in the culture. Often these will be pictured as journeys into miraculous realms, to be interpreted as symbolic of descent into the night sea of the psyche, or realms or aspects of man's destiny that are manifest in the heroic life. But often as well, I think the view here would be that if a potentially heroic individual exists in a culture, that what may often happen is the legend makers go to work and manufacture an appropriate childhood. Right? Well, his parentage was really unclear, and there are these tales that at 3 he overcame monsters, you know, so that there may be a kind of general operation on the part of the culture to construct a heroic tale which corresponds to these patterns the anthropologists have discerned. Now, I want to look at one particular heroic figure in Greek life who just presents a lot of problems. Right away, the central problem about Heracles, not the central problem, but perhaps the most striking aspect about him as a hero, is that he is the most typical exemplar of the heroic pattern, and at the same time, absolutely unique as heroes go. So right away, you've got this paradoxical figure. What I mean by saying the most typical exemplar is that he does fulfill this kind of heroic pattern I've been speaking about pretty much to a T. And I'll try very briefly to run through Heracles' career or relevant aspects of it. It's vast, so I won't be able to cover by any means all that he does. But in all of the many adventures that he has, he does in fact seem to be a paradigmatic case of this kind of heroic figure. At the same time, however, Heracles is utterly unlike any hero, at least certainly in Greek culture. For one thing, for the following reasons, and this is true already in the Homeric texts, and irreconcilable, incomprehensible in a sense, Heracles is discussed in the Homeric texts as being both, in separate places, in separate passages, as being both dead in the underworld and a god on Olympus. So right away, we have a problem here. What really happened to this guy? Now, as if that weren't tricky enough, furthermore, the latter possibility, namely that Heracles has in fact achieved an apotheosis and is now a god, is never true of any other Greek figure. There is a fundamental notion about the Greek cosmos, which has been most clearly studied and elaborated by the French scholar Jean-Pierre Vernon, who has shown, I think, beyond any doubt, that the Greek cosmos is absolutely stratified and ordered in the sense that there are the beasts, there are men, and there are the gods, and one does not cross those boundaries. Now, sometimes life is asymptotic in the sense that a warrior may come very, very close to bestial behavior. He may, on the other hand, come very, very close to crossing that dividing line toward immortality. But finally, neither of those is possible. A man must understand his place as a man, and there can ultimately be no transgression, except for Heracles, who does in some way become a god, so that he is this phenomenal figure in Greek culture. And he even has, again, uniquely, a sort of Christological aspect in that he's not only on Olympus with the gods, in a certain view, but we have evidence kind of inscribed on the thresholds of houses. What's the appropriate? Like a mezuzah, okay? We have evidence that people would inscribe on their thresholds Heracles Kalinikos, meaning Heracles the great victor, as seeming to have some sort of deeply religious significance in an almost Christological sense. As Heracles triumphed over death, so may I, as a believer in Heracles. Now, we don't have a lot of cult practice evident for this, but something was going on there which makes Heracles quite different from other heroes. Right? Now, let me try to just, as I said, sketch out some aspects of his heroic career. The fullest treatment of Heracles is everywhere, right? He is the most frequently represented figure in Greek art, in vase paintings, on buildings, reliefs, and so forth. Heracles is far and away the most represented figure. And his tales are everywhere. He's alluded to in numerous tragedies and epic poems and all the time. But perhaps the fullest treatment of his whole career, which is staggering, comes from a mysterious little work called The Library. And we don't even know exactly who wrote this or when it was written or anything about it. The author is someone named Apollodorus. And I've noted this work for you on your bibliography. Apollodorus, we know nothing about, as I said, except that he was a collector of information. And the reason that his work is called The Library, simply, is that it was considered in antiquity the compendium of all myth. Anything you wanted to know. This is kind of like everything you always wanted to know about myth, but were afraid to ask. You know? Now, it's not a staggeringly inventive work by any means, it's not a good read, I've got to be honest. It's a sort of an encyclopedic listing. Apollodorus tells you everything that ever happened to anyone, and variant versions, and wonderfully variant versions. You know, Orestes, for example, after murdering his mother, Clytemnestra, has to atone for that murder by cutting off a finger. Bet you didn't know that, but Freud would have loved to know that, right? So, and Apollodorus gives you all kinds of juicy little tidbits, as it were, like this. Well, the greatest portion of Apollodorus' library is, in fact, devoted to a lengthy exposition of the career of Heracles, and it goes on and on and on. But I will try and select some moments from that career. There are certainly problems about Heracles, around Heracles' conception. He perfectly fulfills the paradigm of having, in some sense, both a human and a divine father. How does this happen? Heracles' mother, Alcmene, attracts the attention of Jupiter, as does virtually anything that moves. So Jupiter comes down and sleeps with Alcmene. And in fact, he's so taken with her that he bids the stars and the moon stand still so that the night will last for 24 hours. And so he impregnates Alcmene, which is always what happens when a god sleeps with a woman. There's no doubt about conception there. He comes to Alcmene in disguise as her husband. Right? Having left her, oddly enough, her husband, who has been at war, comes home, and Alcmene is somewhat less than thrilled to see him, right? Having just spent 24 hours in bed with him. Amphitryon is surprised by this. He thinks, gee, I've been away so long. Didn't you miss me, dear? Kind of thing. And he proceeds to sleep with his wife, and consequently, she, in fact, time comes to give birth, gives birth to two children. One is Heracles, and one is a kind of twin brother person named Iphicles. Okay? So that you can see how there's a problem here. I mean, there were two beings in the womb. Who's who? Who belongs to which person? You know, so he wonderfully fulfills that part of the paradigm. Now, Hera is generally angry when Zeus goes gallivanting around in this way, and she's extremely angry over the birth of Heracles. And so, in fact, through his entire life and career, Hera will be his nemesis, his great enemy, always trying to do him in one way or another. This begins with his birth, and I don't have time to go into all the details of it. But shortly after his birth, she specifically sends a pair of snakes to attempt to kill the young child in its cradle. And Heracles, of course, being one of these extraordinary, heroic children, just reaches out with his pudgy little baby hands and strangles the snakes. So we know we're dealing with an extraordinary guy here. This also clues Amphitryon in that this is not his son. So things are getting sorted out there. Heracles also fulfills that portion of the heroic tale which talks about an unusual childhood. He is, in fact, banished to live with the flocks. Right? Very unclear. A lot of this information we don't have a lot of detail about. Some elements we do have very detailed myths, but some not. Very early on in his life, he kills a lion. He will later kill a more famous Nemean lion, but at any rate, right away he has an exploit of killing a sort of monstrous animal. All right? And he fathers 50 children. This is an accident, actually. He's staying with a neighboring king, and the king, realizing that Heracles is quite an extraordinary individual, offers him a daughter, of course. This is fairly typical hospitality. I hate to tell you this. But what this king does, however, is, in fact, he has 50 daughters, and he tricks Heracles by sending a different daughter every night for 50 nights. Heracles apparently doesn't care too much about who it is. You know, doesn't notice any distinctions. Okay. Now, very briefly, subsequent elements kind of follow out these sorts of patterns. Heracles is constantly tormented by Hera in one way or another. It is she, for example, who organizes the 50 labors, which he, I'm sorry, not the 50, the 12 labors, which he has to perform. And Heracles himself is subject to overwhelming appetites. Often it's a sexual appetite, which one sees continually manifesting itself through his career. Sometimes it's just appetite. He can be, here again, we have a weird paradox in the case of Heracles. On the one hand, he can be seen as virtually this savior god, Heracles Kalinikos, the beautiful victor. On the other hand, he's sometimes depicted as a buffoon who's just out to find the next bowl of lentil soup. You know, he has a particular fondness for lentil soup. So we see this kind of very peculiar character. Now, there's too much of him in sort of every dimension. Too much appetite, too much sexuality, too much strength. He accidentally kills his children every once in a while. You know, oops. And he does weird things like give away one wife so that he can have another wife. And then he'll accidentally kill friends fairly frequently. There's a wonderful tale, actually, that at one point he was, again, staying with a hospitable king. And the king had his young son serving wine, and Heracles somehow, in taking the wine cup, accidentally knocked the kid off. Oops, I'm sorry. So, one, you know, one wants to understand what's going on with this character of whom there's just too much, you know. Now, one of the most interesting attempts to understand Heracles did not, in fact, take account of his comic aspects, I must admit, but tried to understand this aspect of Heracles, given that, as I've said, Heracles is constantly hounded by and is, in fact, the great enemy of Hera. Why does his name mean kleos, or glory, of Hera? Right? I mean, right away, we look at Heracles, and there's a problem. She hates this guy. Why would he have gotten this name? And this was explored in the 60s, late 60s, in a work called The Glory of Hera by Philip Slater. Again, something of a psychoanalytic critic. And I just want to conclude with a little summary of Slater's theory. Slater believed that what was going on, at least in part, in the Heracles myth was a reflection of Greek society itself. And the pattern that he saw in Greek society was one of a very strong division between the genders, in which, for one thing, Greek marriage would have taken place when the male, and still does today, actually, in modern Greece often, when the male was perhaps 30 years old and the female perhaps 12 years old. So there would be a great dichotomy or disparity between the marital partners. Furthermore, women would be isolated largely within the household and not permitted to go into the outside world. Men, of course, would spend their lives doing commerce and and having conversation in the agora, in other words, very much outside of the household. What Slater developed then was the notion that because of the mother's isolation in the household, often with male children, there developed a peculiar and sort of paradoxical relationship between the mother and the son, which was a kind of love-hate relationship, whereby the mother would project onto her son those qualities or those facets of a husband which she was actually missing, but at the same time would take out on the son the hostility which she felt toward the husband, who in a sense had nothing to do with her and abandoned her to go to the outside world. Now, this was Slater's theory, and he saw it also as one of the major impetuses behind the practice of Greek homosexuality, that one ended up with a male who had sort of ambivalent relationships toward the genders, right? Now, I can't go into his theory fully. It was a very intriguing construction, let's say, and an interesting attempt to map myth onto the society in which it arose. But I want to take one final turn in precisely that direction about the relationship between myth and the society in which it arises. Slater's work, of course, was written in an American culture which was marked by the post-war 1950s development of suburban life, a lifestyle in which women tended to be isolated in the household while men went out into the workplace and pursued an independent life. This phenomenon began to be studied by some sociologists of the American culture who developed the theory that you may know as momism, all right? A fear of women's tremendous influence in this new suburban organization of social life, a fear of women's tremendous influence over young boys and boys' divorce from the world of their fathers and attenuated relationship with the fathers. In the American theory of momism, such a relationship in the household and such a new sort of bonding between mother and son might lead directly to pernicious results, most dramatically homosexuality. Now, what I want to note here is the circular reinscription in Slater's theory. That is, a theory about ambivalence toward women arising out of ambivalence toward women in the theorist's own culture. Right? We might say, then, that Slater's alleged illumination of the heroic career of Heracles really illumines Slater's own Weltanschauung, his own time and worldview. And going further, we might ask whether that's necessarily a bad thing. Perhaps the very function myth performs is as a tool to analyze our own lives and our own cultures. And perhaps that tool is particularly crucial in the case of mythical formations of the heroic life.